Hey there, welcome to SaaS Inbound Podcast. I'm your host, Anna Dana, Head of Growth at SaaS Group, serial acquirer buying wonderful businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get an inside scoop on how they made their business success. And today with me is Denzel, founder of Smarty.ai, building AI employees for SMBs. It's coming. Oh my God. Welcome to the show. Super excited to talk about this.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Sure. And, you know, we just talked about the fact that I had apparently some outdated information. And, you know, Smarty used to be an AI-powered productivity tool. It was personal. And, you know, I feel like I checked the information like a couple of weeks ago. But now it's already not that. And I'm really curious how you pivoted, how you got there. But maybe let's start with your background, because I know folks who are listening might have heard a few of your previous podcasts and know that you started super early. But, you know, maybe let's go there anyway.
Yeah, let me give you the whole primer on me and how we pivoted at Smarty. So I grew up in the Bay Area in California. I was always passionate about computer science, started coding really young, took that passion with me to MIT, where I did a bachelor's and master's in computer science. And my master's had a theoretical focus in AI, but a more thesis project in human-computer interaction. I ended up building a precursor for Slack, but for classrooms. And I probably should have turned that into a startup and tried the founder journey right out of college, but I was scared. I wasn't sure if founder life was for me. So I ended up going to Microsoft instead. Really safe, big tech job. Started as a PM at PowerPoint. Liked it, but wanted to be more technical. So started teaching computer science at like a local community college, and then ended up switching to being a software engineer at Yammer. So I've always been at enterprise productivity. Yammer was like Microsoft's initial version of Slack. I've always been in that collaboration enterprise productivity space. It's really my bread and butter. I really enjoy it too. But I wasn't sure if I wanted to stay in tech. So I was like looking at other opportunities. I tried out a bunch of different possible careers and then decided to go to business school really to try to figure out what I wanted to do next, figure out what I wanted to do with my life, and ended up going back to Boston, was at Harvard for 2 years. And that's really where the idea for Smarty hit me. I was like asking myself, if I could only work on one thing for the rest of my life, what would it be? And I really, at that time, this was pre-ChatGPT, pre-LLMs and generative AI, was telling myself I wanted to be at the cutting edge of AI. And so I started building Smarty as a chatbot for myself. I was trying to build a AI assistant and really a AI employee focused on the admin space. And I was building it for myself, which is one of the big pitfalls that founders make. But it was good because I was very passionate about the space. But it took me a little while to get funding. And so I did a bunch of other things after business school, but was still working on Smarty on the side, but eventually got funded in 2020. And we really hit the ground running trying to build a web app, chatbot, AI assistant. And it was called Smarty. We were trying to take the best features of Calendly, HubSpot, Superhuman, and just trying to bring all of these admin productivity features into one tool that was conversational. And so I was working on that for a few years. And last year, right around this time, I realized that we were not going to hit our metrics for raising that next round, that the space was extremely crowded, that generative AI had really changed the game in terms of like how software should work. And so last summer, I started experimenting with a lot of different business models. And I'll pause here, but that's my spiel to where we got, where we started and how we got to where we are today.
Okay, that's super fascinating and such a story. That's really cool. And, you know, one of the things that kind of hit me while you were talking is also, I guess we'll get there, like with the whole solo founder, female tech. It's pretty amazing what you're doing. But I also always think, because, you know, here on the podcast, I often have tech founders who a lot of times talk about this challenge that they also have. And I feel like, you know, the whole product-led growth was just made by the tech founders who were like, okay, we're not talking to anybody. We'll just make it so awesome that we don't have to. The whole journey from engineering to being a founder to being a CEO, like you said, you weren't sure that it was for you. When did you realize that, okay, maybe it's something I should try? And how did you get there?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I've had a lot of time to think about it. And I think for me, when I was in college, I really didn't see a lot of founders that looked like me. And it didn't seem like a job that was meant for me to do. And I'm not really sure where that imposter syndrome came from. And I really wasn't sure that I wanted the lifestyle that came with it. I wasn't sure that I was capable of succeeding in it. And so all of those factors made me feel like founder life wasn't for me. And then I went to Microsoft and it was a great job. Like, especially like now that I am a founder, I'm like, I sometimes miss it because it was just great salary for work-life balance. And I was able to do really cool things, but I wasn't stressed the way that I'm stressed as a founder. But when I was younger, I wasn't fulfilled in that role because I was like, there's so much more I could be doing. And that's why I ended up choosing to like explore so many different careers. And that's why I went to business school. And then when I got to business school, I looked around and I was like, okay, these are all the career options. Like, what do I really want to do? And now I tell anyone who tells me that they're an aspiring founder, or if they're not sure if they want to be a founder, the fact that you're even asking yourself, like, should I start my own thing, probably means that you should explore it. Like, that's enough, just like the curiosity of that. And then if you have that curiosity to be a founder, I think the best way to figure out what you should work on is by looking at this concept of ikigai. I don't know if you've heard of it. I think
One of
that
my
is.
favorite books.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite like frameworks for thinking about like what you should work on for the rest of your life. And if you have any interest in being a business owner or being a founder, I think looking at that, like looking at where your skill set is, what you're passionate about, where can you do most good for the world, and like what can you make money doing? Like if you find that intersection, that is probably where you should be a founder. And so that's my advice for anyone who's out there who wants to be a founder. That's something that I had to come to over time, but I truly believe that SMARTY is in my ikigai, and I'm not sure if I'm using that correctly, but that's how I think of it, and that's why I'm a founder today.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, thanks for walking me through this. But okay, let's go to the whole pivot situation and like why you started doing it, and was it more of a your personal decision, or were you more mostly pulled into it by your customers?
Yeah, so I made the biggest pitfall mistake that any founder does, which is build and hope the customers will come. I think it's the biggest vulnerability technical founders have because you have the ability to just create things, but then you're not necessarily thinking about it in a business-centered way where you should be chasing revenue, you should be chasing profit, you should be chasing dollar amounts because that's a very tangible metric for what is a customer pain point. Because if a customer is willing to pay for it, it's clearly a pain point that they need to solve. And so I really recommend watching Rob Snyder. I actually went to school with him, and he has a great series on like finding product market fit and why customer discovery interviews are not the best way of for finding or accelerating PMF. It's doing sales calls and figuring out what customers are willing to pay for. And so last year, right around this time, we had been putting all of our investment and resources into building a pure software solution in a crowded space. And we weren't retaining enough customers. We weren't making enough revenue. And there was no way that we were going to be able to hit the metrics we needed to hit in order to raise that re next round of funding. And because I'm a venture-backed company, there are real restrictions around like how I can pivot and how I can grow and what I can do. And there's a real expectation on return of investment. And so really taking all of that into account, I started listening to Rob Snyder and how he is trying to make a real formula around reaching product market fit. And I started playing around with different business models. And I saw this trend in the market around software where instead of just having pure software solutions for customers, you should, especially with AI solutions, use human in the loop, where there's AI tools that are out there, but there's a human element that is monitoring the AI, monitoring the quality of the work, and then working with that client. So there's a real value proposition with human touch points. And I decided that I wanted to experiment with that and the software we had built out. And so last summer, I started playing around with different business models where we started staffing software with humans and working with clients and really trying to figure out, okay, what are clients willing to pay for? How much are they willing to pay? And for what type of work? And that's how we pivoted into SMARTY today.
Oh, right. That reminds me, a colleague recently just shared this like org chart from some kind of I don't know, big influencer kind of business person. I'm not sure who he was, but it was basically like him on top, right, as a CEO, as a founder, And then this huge org chart with, like, I don't know, head of marketing, head of growth, head of engineering, head of, and yada, yada, yada. And then they also had their own teams. But the thing is, the only real person is him there on top. And I was like, okay, that sounds super scary and kind of like weird. But at the same time, pretty amazing. The only issue that I have with it is, how reliable is it from like the business point of view, from the customer point of view? Like, what if one of those little chain points is breaking? Like, what do you do? Like, what do you think? Is it actually possible to kind of substitute the entire company work with AI already? Like, where are we?
I think of Smarty, like the version of the product today, as that bridge between what is possible with AI and what is possible by human experts. And so the way that Smarty works today, we're building out AI employees for these different specialties that a client might be working in. And so similar to that org chart that you were talking about, the way that we work with our clients today is that the client works with a human engagement manager who understands their business, understands their OKRs, their KPIs, like what are their goals and metrics that they're tracking and the context of their business. And then that engagement manager hires human experts for the different types of work that the customer might have. Those human experts are trained on AI tools, automation, and they either get us to build the right AI tools for them, or they use third-party tools that are already out in the market. And so the way that we kind of control for that quality concern between what is AI capable of doing and what the client actually deserves is we have actual human specialists that are bridging that gap. And the value proposition that we're providing for our customers is that we hire and train that talent. We allow our clients to scale up or scale down whatever sort of work they need month to month. And then we are working on using data to build out these AI automations as the client needs them, and then trying to find other customers like that.
All right. That's interesting. So there is a person that you hire for that specific customer. And
no, we have our own team. So it's just folks on our team, just experts, but we'll staff an expert for the client.
Oh, I see. All right. Okay. Tell me maybe a little bit more about the scalability of that model.
So we have different types of businesses, a lot of coaches. And so they all have like the same needs. They have podcasts that they need video editing. They want content written for those podcasts. They want social media managed in terms of scheduling all of that content strategically. And then they want to send out a weekly newsletter. They have like all of these things that is like very mix and match for every coach, right? Every coach wants to do that to help them scale their business. And all of this is possible with AI, but there's all of these like holes with AI as well. There's no quality assurance. There's no one to bridge all of this together. And there's no one to manage the client's needs and understand their context. And so for those areas where we need to bridge, we have human experts. And then for all of the actual like bulk of the work, we use AI, and then humans come in and improve it to make it work well for that client.
Okay. It seems like I need to use you guys.
Maybe. We have a lot of podcasts as clients.
Yeah, because honestly, it's been hard. I used freelancers twice, trying to outsource the editing and, you know, the scheduling and everything. Both times failed miserably. And I feel like, yeah, maybe I just need like really good AI Smarty for this.
Yeah. No, you should think about using Smarty. And like a lot of our customers, it's the same experience. Like they've tried outsourcing the work themselves, but they don't have the time to train this outsourced talent or like get the quality that they want. And you get burned once or twice, and then you decide it's not worth your time and effort. And so that is kind of the value proposition that we're providing our clients, is like, we handle everything. We do the quality assurance, and then your engagement manager works with you to understand like what you like, what you don't like, and make sure that the quality of work matches that.
Yeah, that makes great sense. But again, to that scalability point, because you have to involve a human, how would it work like when you have, I don't know, thousands and thousands of businesses working with you?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure it out. So we're trying to figure out, how do you scale? How do you grow this to the next level? And like, how do you do it in a way that is easy to scale as well? And so those are all things that we're trying to figure out now. But for me, I'm still at that 0 to 1 stage. I still haven't really found product market fit. And so I think we're closer than we've ever been, but we're still trying to figure out like, okay, what is the foundational staffing model? Like what is like the core client that we want to go after and how do we scale from there?
Yeah, interesting. But I think it's a really great thing that you found, because even with, you know, with freelancers, obviously you have to train them and have all those calls and everything. And I think with AI, the misconception is often is that you just say, oh, do this for me. And then it does it. And then it's shit. And you're like, yeah. Oh, no. Why? But it's actually the same thing. You have to train it. You have to teach it. And I think bridging that gap is a really smart move.
So for a lot of our clients, they have AI fatigue, and these clients, it's the whole range of AI understanding. Like we have clients that like just have a vague idea, like AI can do this, but I don't know how to do it, or I don't know how to use AI at all. And then we have clients that are AI experts, like they are tinkering with AI on a daily basis and they know what AI is capable of, but they don't want to deal with the AI fatigue. They don't want to like train the AI. They don't want to like keep doing the QA. It's a lot of work. They want to just outsource all of that. So our clients are kind of all over in terms of their AI understanding. But I think it's a real thing now, AI fatigue, where you know what's possible and what AI can do, but you don't necessarily want to do all the work to get there.
Yeah, it's fascinating how fast we got to this. Yeah. It's absolutely crazy.
I agree.
All right. So what do you think are the kind of the business challenges that, that are possible with integrating with AI? And like, what have you seen already your customers experience?
I think it's exactly what you were saying. I think the biggest challenge with AI is that you're investing all of this money into AI agents or AI automations or building out these automations or trying to figure out like, how to use RAG with your company data and the models that are available. And then you get outputs that just don't match the quality of like the humans that were doing the work before. And so I think that disconnect between what is AI capable of and how does it actually move the revenue compass or the revenue markers, that is the biggest concern for businesses today. Because you don't want to not invest in AI and be behind while your competitors are doing it, but then you also don't want to spend too much money without the outcomes that you need.
Absolutely. We had so many conversations here about AI, obviously, this last year. And there are still, you know, some founders that are like, okay, we're still watching. We're still kind of like trying to figure out what everyone else is doing because we don't want to jump on something where we don't necessarily see the value right away. And some are just like, okay, let's do it. Let's just put it somewhere. Let's figure it out later, how it works, what kind of cost it adds. And I don't know which way is right or wrong, but everyone's thinking about it for sure.
I mean, I definitely have an opinion about what's wrong. Like you can't just wait and watch and like hope that like the right solution will pop up. Like I do think you have to be thinking about like, okay, what type of AI automation do I need at my company and what should I invest in today? You can't be totally blinded to it. But I also think there is a smart and strategic way to do it. You don't want to just be investing without understanding how it's going to help you long term.
Absolutely. So, since we started talking about, you know, the 0 to 1 and how you're still kind of trying to figure it out, I wonder how you work with your customers, how they affect your roadmap and who actually are, because you mentioned coaches and maybe at this point it's kind of the main ICP that you have, but I know for a fact that it constantly changes when you're early stage. So has it changed already? Are you looking for, you know, the next kind of step? What's the most challenging part of this 0 to 1 for you?
I think right now, like today, because it changes day to day, I am trying to figure out like who is our favorite ICP and how do we describe them in order to figure out like positioning, marketing, and growing. In terms of our customers, we've had a whole range. So like I spent the last 6 months really working with anyone and trying to understand like, okay, how does this business model work for them and how much are they willing to pay for it and how well does it help them grow in their business and help with their bottom line. And so we've had over 15 customers and they've been in a range of different like experiences from coaches to communities to just small businesses. And so now I'm trying to figure out, okay, which one is the one that we should narrow in on and scale with.
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
Okay. Yeah, I should definitely be the number 16. It sounds very, very promising. How do you figure out the pricing? Because again, I keep getting back to that person in the loop. How does it affect the pricing? And because it's also fairly customizable, as far as I understand, again, how does it work?
Yeah, so pricing is always hard as a founder. It's very subjective when you're early stage, and it's really around, because there's a lot of value you get from customers beyond revenue, right? You get their data, you get learnings, you get understanding. So you often underprice as founders, I feel like. And so I'm also really struggling with pricing and trying to figure out like, okay, what is actually fair for the work that we deliver? And sometimes the best way to figure out pricing is by looking at competitors, like looking at how they're charging for things. So I don't know. I haven't figured out the answer to pricing.
Okay. But you do have a SaaS model.
Yes. Everyone's on a retainer. Okay. They stay month to month, but they can increase or decrease their retainer every month depending on how much work they have. So we've had a few customers actually increase the scope of work and increase their monthly retainer over time.
Okay. Interesting. So the price mostly depends on that person that's involved there.
The business.
Okay.
Yeah. And what we're trying to standardize it. Like we're trying to standardize, like if we're working with a business that is using like a weekly newsletter and daily social media content and editing videos and podcasts, like what is that package worth?
Mm. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Let's talk after that. But another thing that I wanted to ask you, you know, because, well, AI is, well, at least, it, you know, it seems in our little bubble that it's so saturated already, and you know, new AI tools pop up every hour, but at the same time, you know, they die every hour. So what are you doing in terms of like making sure that what you guys are building is something that is long-term and, you know, lasting?
Yeah, it's so true. I do think right now where it's kind of like when the iPhone first came out, like there are all of these apps that are popping up, and eventually it's going to trickle down into where is the most value being captured. And I think the best part of our business right now is that a lot of the software is abstracted out. So the clients know that we are keeping track of what are the best AI tools on the market. We are trying to either build out the best AI tools, or we're trying to find the best AI tools to get their workflows done, but they don't actually have to deal with it. They don't have to figure out what's the best tool. They don't have to actually figure out how to use the tool. We're doing all of that for them, or we're building out tools for them. And so for us, it's actually kind of nice to see the spike in all of the AI adventures and experimentation that founders are doing. And then we can learn from them while we're still focused on our value proposition, which is just around serving the clients and helping them with their outcomes. So instead of, you asked if we were a SaaS business, instead of software as a service, we're a little bit more outcomes as a service. We're trying to really focus on what are the outcomes the founders or our clients want and helping them just deliver on those outcomes. Whether we use AI, whether we use automation, whether we use human labor.
Okay. All right. And, you know, one of the things that I always try to ask when we talk about AI, because it's such a also broad thing, and there are a lot of opinions on like what it is. When we're talking about AI with you, what are we talking about?
Yeah, it's a great question because when I talk to my customers as well, they'll say like AI, AI. And I'm like, actually, like this is not AI. This is just automation. You know, there are different types of AI. And a lot of when customers talk about AI, for me, at least right now, they're thinking generative AI. And generative AI is very much you have a lot of content and you're trying to create more of that content. So you have a lot, like whatever the content is, whether that content is like actual text, whether it's images, whether it's code. Generative AI is learning from existing data to create new data, but it's based off the data that it's already been processing. And you have like automation, which is really like if this, then that, or like actual recipes of like follow these steps and just automate how those steps work through. And for most of our clients, we're actually doing mostly just automation. We're not even really touching on AI. And if we do touch on AI, it's very, very basic.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Because, you know, I always ask like how you started adding AI to your SaaS tool here. And yeah, mostly it's just, you know, kind of hearing about the new trends and trying the new tools. And almost never, I think today actually was the first time ever that a founder said, hey, it's our customers that we're kind of, they're bigger clients. So they already had some kind of AI experimentation done there. And they came back to us and they were like, okay, when are you guys having AI anything? But mostly it's just, like at least that's what I hear. It never really happens because, yeah, that's exactly the case. Like, no one really understands what AI is and like what it's capable of and where it could be implemented. And that's why kind of customer-driven adoption of AI is not really possible.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I think for a lot of our customers, they kind of leave it up to us to figure out where can AI be most useful. And at the end of the day, again, they're more concerned about the outcomes of their business than they are about like how we get there.
Okay. Yeah. Fascinating. I think I would be totally the same.
Because but, it doesn't matter how much of it was AI or how much of it was automation. All that matters is, does it work? Yes. Does it do what I want?
Exactly. Does it solve my problem? Do I have to train the third freelancer or not? Yeah. But yeah. Okay. So I think we finally got there because, you know, I'm really interested every time, and it's not that often that it happens that I get a female founder here. I always want to ask, and, you know, just a couple of days ago, I finished this new blog post about the exit gap. And, you know, some of the statistics that I found were just, oh, my God, mind blowing. And it was just like something of like 1.5% of exits in Europe are of female-led companies. And you're like, what? 1.5, that's crazy.
Crazy.
But yeah, you're solo, you're a tech founder. How does it feel?
You know, it's so crazy because when sometimes you can take those numbers and feel really disheartened, right? Like less than 2% of funding in the United States goes to women founders, and like less than 1.5% of exited companies in Europe are female-led. Like those are really bleak numbers objectively if you're like a pessimistic perspective, but you can also look at it as very optimistic, which is like, hey, at least it's better than 0%, and you know, hopefully it's getting higher every year. I don't think it is, unfortunately, for the 2%, which is still bleak, but I think for me, like, my perspective on it is, I mentioned imposter syndrome earlier and like why I didn't want to be a founder coming out of college, because I just didn't think it was something I could do. And I wish I had known this then, but like for me, the difference between imposter syndrome and a growth mindset is that imposter syndrome is I can't do this, but a growth mindset is I can't do this yet. This idea that you were capable of doing it and you just have to work towards getting there. And now whenever I hear these numbers, like, I don't know if we'll have a exit, but I could say like, I can't do it, or I can't do it and I can't get to that exit. Or I can say like, I can't do it yet. I can't get to that exit today, but maybe I can get to that exit in like 3 years. If I just keep using the data, keep working and staying persistent. And I've been working on Smarty for a long time, and I think, you know, it's just going back to that concept of ikigai, it's like something that I truly believe that I want to be doing and I'm meant to be doing. And if I put enough time and effort and data-driven action behind it, I'm hopefully going to get there. And I have to hope for that and I have to have faith. And I can't let like bleak statistics get me down. If anything, I should like turn that around and say like, okay, I can be part of that if I keep going. And I hope that like for all the female founders that are listening, like you feel inspired to just changing those numbers and make them better.
Loving the mindset, honestly. What helped you in the first place? Like you said, you know, there are not too many female founders and, you know, yeah, let's hope it's changing. Let's hope there are a bit more like equal opportunities out there. But yeah, what helped you develop that mindset and kind of stay this positive about, you know, the future and what you're doing?
You know, founder life is high highs and low lows. And even this week, I've had high highs and low lows. It's really hard to keep your emotional state steady. And I think I'm still working on this and still dealing with it. But I think having work-life balance and keeping track of your health is the number one thing that you can do to like stabilize your emotional state. Like getting enough sleep, working out, eating healthy. I definitely, for the first couple of years of my startup, and even like now still struggle with like taking care of myself. And like the more I've realized, the more I take care of myself, the better mindset and clarity I have when I'm coming into my work. And then I think the biggest hurdle as a founder that you have to deal with is that your identity is really tied to your product, to your startup, to your business, because you feel like all of your worth is in the company's value. And I think having a little bit of objective space is helpful because your identity is not your startup, and you developing that space and then really thinking about your business objectively is only going to help you grow your business because you'll be more focused on the data and you'll be more focused on what is actually working and converting to growth metrics than what you feel or what you think. So I don't know. Those are some of the things that have been helping me recently.
Yeah, that's really interesting what you said, you know, just, you know, being a bit more disciplined in, you know, how you do you. And it's not necessarily some kind of external inspiration, which, you know, helps. But I feel like I would agree here with you. The more you kind of just focus on what you're doing and what's good for you, the better and easier. I mean, you kind of in a way eliminate other options and then it just becomes a lot clearer.
SaaS Group is partnering with SaaSTalk USA, taking place May 13th to 14th in Austin, Texas. This is where heads-down SaaS founders and their teams move their business forward. As a partner, we have 30% discount available to share with our network. Use code SaaSGroup30 in all capital letters and see you there.
Yeah, and actually, okay, so building on that, because those were all very subjective things, right? Like emotional things that you can do about your body and about yourself and your mental health, which is all very important because as a founder, you have to be very strong mentally and physically to be able to lead your business. So it's important to work on that. But then when you come down to the business, what I've learned over the past few years is 0 to 1, as much as people say it's very subjective and there's like no right path to 0 to 1, I think going back to Rob Snyder, his whole thing is that there are systems and there is a formula that will help you get from 0 to 1. And there are the right things to be doing and the right things to be focusing on with your time when you're in that 0 to 1 space. And then from 1 to 10, there are different systems that you should be focusing on. And then 10 to 100, there are different systems that you should be focusing on. And so as a founder, making sure that the choices you're making are really built on top of what really matters at the stage you're at, and building systems, like you were saying, like not letting it be so subjective, like having real, like data-driven actions is going to make you feel better because you're going to be like, oh, I'm doing all the right things. So if I keep doing those right things, I should be able to get there. I think I didn't have that understanding when I first started as a first-time founder. I often wish that Smarty hadn't been my first startup because I now have lessons that I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, that makes great sense. And, you know, yes, maybe there is a bit of a FOMO, like that could have been your, like you said, I think you had another idea at the beginning for a business. But hey, you know what? I think like now having AI as your first business and moving so fast, maybe that's even more thrilling.
Also, you know, it's very easy to have like rose-colored glasses. Like if I had done that startup like right out of college, it was an education startup. Like education is not a space that I think has like a lot of venture-backed like gains. It's very tough to have a venture-backed education startup.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, since we hit that, and yeah, that's another thing that a lot of female founders are struggling with. It's VC funding. How did you get to a point when you understood that, you know, this is something that I'm going with, this is maybe just easier to move faster, or maybe to have a bit of an easier maybe path in a way, because then you're able to experiment, you're able to pay yourself decent salary and stuff like that. What was the decision behind this?
So I first started thinking about Smarty in 2018. So it was a very different venture market back then. And it never even occurred to me that like you could start a startup without venture capital. Like I thought you needed venture capital to start a company. Otherwise, how were you possibly going to do it? And I think that's not true. That wasn't true then. It's very much not true now. It is easier than ever today to prototype a product with no funding and actually start earning money from customers, manually doing services for them, and then figuring out how to bootstrapping it, or even like using customer revenue to like start a company. I think it's easier than ever now to start a company without venture backing. And I think even when I was first thinking about Smarty, it was possible to do it without venture backing, but I didn't know. It was like not in my realm of understanding how to do that. So I always knew that I wanted to be venture backed, and I wasn't going to start working on Smarty full time until I was venture backed. And so that is how I thought about it then. And then I ended up going through an accelerator, which made it really easy for me to get started. And I was very lucky that this accelerator let me in. It was Pear Ventures out in California, because I was a first time female founder who was solo, who didn't know what she was doing, and they took a chance on me. And I think it's partially because I met one of the founding partners of Pear in business school, and I stayed in touch and I sent her updates. And I think she was just like, your resilience and grit is why we want to let you in, because I wasn't the product at the time and it wasn't like the metrics that I had. So I think it must have just been my resilience and grit more than anything else. And once I raised money, then I just kind of kept going through that rat race adventure of like proving out metrics, showing where the customers are, where the demand is, and then using that to raise that next round of funding. And I do think raising venture is a game. It is, you have a hand to play, and if you play it correctly, it will determine how much money you raise. And so it's about strategy, it's about the narrative, it's about the storytelling, and it's about playing the game. And so that's just how it works, especially at early stage funding. Like it's much more subjective because they don't have a lot of data to decide whether to fund you or not. I think later stage startups, it's a lot easier. There's real data around why are they investing and how much they're investing. But I don't think today founders need to worry about venture. I really think if I could go back to myself even then, I would say like, focus on the fundamentals of the business. Like, where's the revenue coming from? Who are the customers? How are you building out a profit margin? That is stuff you have to figure out. And raising venture kind of just gives you more time to figure it out, but it's not necessarily the right thing. It's better to like focus on business fundamentals. And I think today it's much easier to do that than ever before.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. Okay. So I have a couple more questions for you. This is just something that's usual here. You know, you've been doing Smarty for a few years and you've went through this pivot. What has been the biggest win and the biggest failure?
I think the biggest failure for sure is what I've already said, which is building a product and hoping the customers would come instead of focusing on doing sales and figuring out where the revenue was and what are customers willing to pay for. If I could do it all over again, I would start over with that in mind, like chasing the money and like trying to find pain points that kind of match up with my vision of what I that's my biggest failure. My biggest win, I think, would be, I don't know, it's, I guess, it's funny because we're still so much in this journey. We're still 0 to 1. I guess the win is just getting closer to 1 every day. Like just the fact that we're still alive, that we're still trying to get there, and that we have more data and more clarity around our vision than we did a year ago. I think the learnings at the end of the day are the biggest win you have as a founder.
All right. Yeah. I noticed that you keep saying data and like data driven and, you know, just following the metrics and everything. And I feel like it's very like you have that plan and you have the goal and your North Star metric. So what exactly, if you may share a little bit, maybe what are the metrics that you're looking at when you determine success for Smarty?
I think I emphasize data so much now is because I think it's really important to have something objective that you are tracking, because it makes it easier for you to chase it and to like build systems to find it. Because if you don't have those systems, as we were talking, you'll be very lost as a founder because there's so many unknown unknowns and there's so many things you could be doing that it's very easy to be overwhelmed. And so to have focus, you have to have data, and to have data, you have to know what to track. And so for me today, like the number one thing that I'm tracking is like today specifically is the profit margin of my customers and how to find more of the customers that have the highest profit margin. So like that is like where my focus is today. And that's what I'm chasing. I'm chasing at the end of the day, like revenue, and then taking such a broad term as revenue and like figuring out like, what does that mean? And how do I find more of it? And I think at that 0 to 1 stage, I do think that's what founders should be focused on. They should be focused on revenue more than profit, actually, just revenue. Because if someone, going back to this point, instead of doing customer discovery, do sales. And if a customer is willing to pay you to solve a problem, that's a real problem that they have. And so that's where to start.
Yeah, absolutely. I think revenue has been kind of the top metric that all the founders mentioned when they ask about the metrics that they're tracking. All right. And then, yeah, the last question is always about a hack. So it can be anything. It can be something that, you know, helps you find the right customers, helps you as a sole founder, anything that, you know, works and that you think other founders would benefit from.
I think when you're in the 0 to 1 stage, founder-led sales is the only thing you should focus on, because you need to maximize your learnings of the customer. And I actually think it's not a hack, but like manually doing services for the customer, like manually servicing them, is the best way for you to accelerate your learning and then figure out how to scale that later. So it's not a hack, but it's good fundamentals.
Awesome. All right. Yeah. I mean, I love when it's just kind of, you know, common sense, but man, like you develop this tunnel vision and you forget about all these things and you're like, step out of it. Learn the fundamentals. That's great.
All right. I am.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the story. And it's really fascinating to learn how this whole 0 to 1 works for you. And honestly, I would love to talk about what you're doing, how you're doing it, and maybe, you know, apply it for me. Because it sounds like it's just the right fit. But yeah, thanks so much for being here.
It was such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for all the really great questions. And I'm excited to connect.
Awesome. Yeah. I'll stay in touch. And take care.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders, and if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.